The God Delusion, a Jewish Response to Dawkins, the Beach Lecture for 2010. Will you please welcome Rabbi Jonathan Romaine?
Right, well, as you've just heard, we are under attack. Not just Jews, but anyone connected with religion. And those making the assault include Christopher Hitchens, but have been particularly led, as we've just heard from the chairman, by Richard Dawkins. And whereas there have always been people who don't believe, Dawkins and Hitchens have been unusual in what they are now termed as militant atheists. In other words, engaged in a campaign to actively combat what they see as the evils of religion. The problem is that part of what they say is absolutely right. There are aspects of faith that are totally daft. There are some religious people, or people who claim to be religious people, who are contemptible or even dangerous. Think of, and these are extreme examples, think of some of the American TV evangelists, perhaps epitomized by that notorious episode in which Oral Roberts once told his television audience that God would kill him unless they gave his mission $8 million. And not only that, the real horror is that, unbelievably, it worked, and they did give. A more respectable personality was Pope John Paul II, and yet who told the faithful that the assassination attempt on his life failed. Why? Because, quote, the Virgin Mary guided the bullet away from me. Now that's great, and I'm glad she did, but what a shame that she doesn't intervene more often. Or, in an entirely different league, you may recall, this is about 10, 11 years ago, the Reverend Paul Hill standing outside an abortion clinic in Florida. And when one of the doctors who worked at the abortion clinic arrived, he pulled out, not a Bible, but a shotgun, and killed him. Why? Well, because in the Reverend Paul Hill's own words, to prevent the death of innocent people. Quite. And after his trial, he went to his death, his own death, happy in the knowledge that he would be dying a martyr. So, yes, there's a lot of religious lunatics out there. And I haven't even mentioned, of course, Muslim suicide bombers and their sickening assumption that God glories in the blood and destruction that they cause. Now, of course, you may have noticed that so far these illustrations have been Christians and Muslims. Now, how do Jews, how do my lot fare in the Dawkins catalogue of religious travesties? Well, he doesn't like the Hebrew Bible either. Listen to this. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous, and proud of it, a bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, misogynist, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's not bad for a put-down, is it? All of which was presupposed in the title of Dawkins' book, which, as we've just heard, The God Delusion. While that of Christopher Hitchens' work, which you may also have come across, is equally forthright, God is not great. And he is equally scathing about the effects of faith, summing it up in his conclusion, his very last line, religion poisons everything. And just as we may have nodded over the criticism of Christian extremists and agreed about Muslim fanatics, we Jews also have to admit that there are parts of the Hebrew Bible that are pretty unsavoury. Although it doesn't take Dawkins to get us to say that. In fact, we worked that out for ourselves long ago. which is precisely how rabbinic Judaism, in other words, the Judaism of today, sort of as interpreted over the centuries by the rabbis, adapted the faith to new conditions and new perspectives, by which I don't mean the sort of 1990s and 2000s, but in the year sort of 1000 or 1200 or whatever, changing the leadership from the priests, you know, the Kohens and the Levites who so dominate in the Bible, changing the leadership from the priests to the rabbis, going from what was effectively a caste system, it was a hereditary system, to one based on learning and knowledge, giving up the sacrifices and instead worshipping through prayer and the offerings of the heart. We had a C of E teacher who came to the synagogue the other day and we did a guided tour for her school, and she said, it's very interesting because we showed all the artifacts. She said, but where do you do the sacrifices? And I had to say, we actually haven't done them for 2,000 years. Part of me wanted to say, come over here in the kitchen, I'll show you where the blood drains away. But I thought, no, she might believe me, and the children wouldn't appreciate it either. And also we have interpreted away difficult passages, such as an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which the rabbis, something around about the year 100, decided did not mean literally an eye for an eye, because, of course, if I poke your eye out and you poke my eye out, all that achieves is a world of one-eyed people. They said, no, it means an eye's worth for an eye, not physical retribution, but financial compensation. And by that, they meant that if I poked your eye out, I had to pay you a compensation for the pain, for the public embarrassment, for the time off work, for the medical fees. And by the way, this, remember, was 100 CE. So we're not talking about Bupa and PPE, but we are going a long way back. So, Massive changes, which is why if you look at the Bible and then you look at Jewish life today, it's hugely different. And why, of course, we are called rabbinic Jews, because we simply do not live out the Bible today, but we have lived it out as interpreted and refined by the rabbis. And that process of development is also why the particular strand that I represent, Reform Judaism, as opposed to Orthodox Judaism, why Reform Judaism arose, taking it one stage further, holding that, yes, while the Bible is a source of enormous value, it also contains material that may have been appropriate once, but is no longer applicable today, such as stoning rebellious children. It's no disgrace to admit that we don't stone rebellious children, and that we shouldn't do so anyway. What would be a disgrace would be to deny that and pretend that everything in the Bible was wonderful, or, to go to the other extreme, and to abandon the Bible altogether, both the inspirational passages and the outdated ones. And so Reform Judaism tries to marry the best of the traditions of the past with the insights and knowledge of modernity, partly in practical matters, for instance, such as treating women as equal, or saying that the ban on work on the Sabbath, which is in the Bible, does not include travelling by car because it isn't work. Yes, saddling your donkey, who was sort of obstinate and dirty and smelly and having to go through, forests or whatever, where you could be waylaid by brigands or whatever, that may have been arduous and time-consuming and not a Sabbath activity, but getting in the car, turning on the ignition, going down to the local church or synagogue, being part of the community, that is not work. That actually enhances religiosity and sense of community, and that is permissible. But also, Reform Judaism tries to amend things not just in terms of practical aspects, but also in principles, and trying to focus on what is truly religious, such as good relations with other people, particularly those who are different from us in whatever way, and not get so besotted with detail that we miss the whole point of it all and end up doing ridiculous things, such as, to quote some of my lunatics, those ultra-Orthodox Jews who consider it a sin to drive on the Sabbath, and therefore they will stone an ambulance on the Sabbath in Jerusalem, which to me totally undermines undermines the whole value of goodness and religion, and that's the difference between religious fanaticism and religious truth. In other words, always, always asking before you do or say something, is this what God really wants? Am I making the world a better place by what I'm saying or doing? And do my actions enhance the lives of others, or do they diminish them? And so, Richard Dawkins, an eminent scientist who fully concurs with Darwin and his evolutionary principles, he should also appreciate, and this is what I think one of his great, great mistakes, he should also appreciate that evolution applies to religion too, and not confuse the modern version with the perhaps older, more primitive dinosaur version. But also, what about the positive aspects that he fails to mention? Even Dawkins admits, grudgingly, that much human progress has come from those inspired by faith to work for the greater good of humanity. Think of what? Think of hospitals. Think of schools. Think of the fight against the slave trade, all led by religious people. Think of organizations who were founded by religious individuals, such as the Red Cross, the NSPCC, Alcoholics Anonymous, the Samaritans, Amnesty International, the RSPCA, Oxfam, the National Trust. Those are wonderful organizations and a wonderful gift of the religious people to the rest of the world. Think of religious art or architecture or music or literature. Now, that doesn't justify a crusade or a jihad, but it does show there is something powerful that can be used for enormous good and not just the destructive purposes that Dawkins likes to quote. And on a personal level, there are many who are not religious, but who can still find a religious funeral service very moving, be it the rich themes of life and death expressed in the prayers, or the love and remembrance, or the dramatic act of filling in the grave that is so heartbreaking and yet so important to the grieving process, or the structured way of mourning that a religious life offers. And we also know, and I'm sure you, particularly those who are associated with this college or surrounding churches, will know of many whose lives have been changed for the better through their religion. How it can help average people rise above themselves, surprise others with what they are capable of. How it can be the bedrock for those who desperately need the support to stay away from drink or drugs or crime. How it can make powerful people more humble and patient, and how it can teach the talented to measure time, to establish priorities, and to value relationships. Now, Dawkins doesn't deny that, but he says that the price is too high, and that all the good the religion can achieve is outweighed by the bad. And he quotes centuries of religious wars, be it between faiths, trying to kill as many of each other's adherents as possible in the name of a supposedly loving God, or between members, as unfortunately we all know too well, between members of the same faith, incandescent with rage at those who interpret the same set of scriptures differently, be it Sunnis and Shias, or Catholics and Protestants, or Orthodox and Reformed Jews, this sect against that sect. Once again, there really is no point denying it, although it's also worth pointing out that you don't have to be religious to be murderous. And after all, the greatest crimes of modern times have been carried out by who? By those with no faith at all, aren't they? Hitler. Or a Stalin, or a Mao, or a Pol Pot, which rather suggests that the fault line is not so much religion, but human nature. And that's why the very same religion can be used by some for purposes of peace and others for war. That Catholicism, for instance, can produce at the same time, literally at the same time, a Mother Teresa and the IRA bombers coexisting and doing what they're doing in the name of the same God. And that what determines whether Catholicism is a force for good or for bad is actually the people who put it into practice. While on my side of the border, there are Jews who are saints and Jews who are flipping maniacs, both influenced by the same Judaism, but heading down entirely different paths. So here, Dawkins and others are primarily attacking fundamentalism, extremists among all religions who oppress others in the name of God. He's not talking about ordinary religious people, moderate religious people, sensible religious people. And to me, religion is a lot about common sense. But that's not his target. He goes for the easy targets of the extremists and the dinosaurs. Still, to be fair, Dawkins and co. also go one step further, and they hold that all religions are based on a falsehood, and that there is no God, not even the nice liberal one that I and maybe you proclaim. And as for his answer as to what instead explains the origins of the world, well, that's simple, and we heard it from Stephen Hawking as well very recently, and that is science. Except that even Dawkins concedes that science doesn't have all the answers, and that the further back you go, the more question marks arise, and that we don't actually know what is the true source of existence. Whilst on top of that, the most rational of philosophers, people like Wittgenstein, admitted, quote, that even when we have answered all possible scientific questions, the problem of life remained completely untouched. By which he means everyday life and the way that you and I behave and act and interact with others. In fact, there's a lovely passage from the writer Albert Camus, who complained to an atheist friend who was extolling the supremacy of science. He says, you know, he says to the atheist friend, you teach me that this wondrous and multicolored universe can be reduced to an atom, and that the atom can be reduced to the electron. All this is good, and I wait for you to continue. But then you tell me of some invisible planetary system in which electrons gravitate around a nucleus. You explain this world to me with an image, and I realize that you have been reduced to poetry, and we shall both never know this true origin. What need have I of such efforts? The soft lines of these hills that I see and the hand of this evening on the troubled heart teach me much more. I have realized that if through science I can understand phenomena and categorize them, yet for all that I cannot comprehend people around me. And that's surely the main point, isn't it? That science and religion are actually engaged in two entirely different tasks. That science is about complex technical explanations. Religion is about how we see ourselves, how we interact with others, and what values should guide us. Two entirely different tasks. And there's actually no reason at all why they have to be in conflict and to have all these running skirmishes. And what's more, and I'm sure you've seen this in conversations that you've had with others, that the attempts really to argue over God are totally futile. I mean, you can't prove God. I mean, yes, you can summon up all sorts of philosophical justifications, or you can point to texts, or you can even cite miracles. But by and large, and certainly this has been my experience, I don't know what yours is, but by and large, people believe because they believe. And it's just something within them. I mean, for instance, you may have heard the Radio 4 programs this time last year, called Humphreys in Search of God, when he interviewed all the sort of religious good and the greats, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the chief rabbi, and a leading Muslim, genuinely trying to find out the reason for faith. And did you notice, every single one of them, however learned, however articulate, they all failed to convince him for the simple reason that they already believed and he didn't. But it's equally futile to try and disprove God. Atheists can marshal all the intellectual arguments they like, but all it does is just to give an orderly package to their own instincts, a sort of atheist theology. But it doesn't deter those who do believe. And this perhaps touches on a problem that is that perhaps God rather like that other three-letter word we use, sex, it's become a taboo. I mean, sex was the great Victorian taboo, wasn't it? You thought about it, yeah, of course, all the time, but you never spoke about it. And it was avoided to such an extent that they even covered up the piano legs so as to try and hint, to hide away any hint of it. And in some ways, sort of, God occupies the same position for our time. Yeah, thought of, yes, but sort of seen as an embarrassing word, as almost a biblical cliche, a sign of sort of underlying superstition or emotional weakness. It's just not right to mention God in polite company because you might sort of embarrass them. And for many Jews in particular, their belief has nothing to do with the rational debates. They talk about a sense of God, and they might derive it from nature and its complexity and its beauty and its awesomeness. Or they might derive it from Jewish history and the astonishing tale of survival against all the odds. Or they might get it from personal moments when, however fleetingly, they do pierce the veil and they do experience the numinous. Or they might get their sense of God from communal endeavours and the camaraderie that arises and develops them. And we all know that you can sing a song to God, but when there's 10 of you singing together, it just sounds so much better and is always more than the number of people in the room. Or from the sound of children's voices laughing in a playground, that it carries something more. It carries a sense of eternity. Or from a blood-red sunset that drops slowly in the ocean, but although it's gone, it leaves behind in you a sense of inner warmth. Now, none of those can be put into a mathematical formula. None of those can be tested under a microscope, but they're real and abiding, and some of those experiences can actually last a lifetime. But here's the strange thing. If you ask... if you ask a non-Jewish person how they would define a Jew, I'd imagine that 7 out of 10, maybe more, would say something like, well, he wears a sort of a funny sort of hat when he prays and puts it on his head, he has Sabbath on a Saturday or on a Sunday, and he doesn't eat pork. In other words, most would describe a Jew from a point of view of dress or of eating habits. And very few would talk about beliefs and say, oh, yes, a Jew, that's an ethical monotheist, a person who believes in the one good and seeks to lead a moral life. If you asked a Jew how he would define a Jew, he'd probably say someone born of a Jewish mother. In other words, describing Judaism from a racial point of view. And again, probably wouldn't dream of saying, oh, a Jew, someone who adheres to the covenant of God made at Sinai and follows the teaching of Moses. And yet ask the same person to define a Christian, and you'd immediately get, someone who believes in Jesus. And as for the Jewish view of God, as opposed to belief, that's a very curious question. Almost a non-Jewish question. You know, for several years I was the judge of the Preacher of the Year competition, which some of you may know was run by the Times, and one thing that stood out was the difference between the Jewish sermons and the Christian sermons that I had to go along and listen to. Jewish sermons tended to be about practical things, about business ethics, about how to cope with cancer, whereas the Christian ones were all about the same subject, belief in God. Now, that was their central message, whereas for Jewish preachers, it was actually as if it didn't really matter whether you believed in God, preferably you did, but even if you didn't, there was still the question of business ethics, how do you cope with cancer? I'd imagine that one person here may have read a book of mine called Faith and Practice. It's a guide to Judaism today. And it got reviewed by one of your lot, Richard Harris, former Bishop of Oxford. And he said, it was an astonishing review, he said, this is a typical Jewish book. 200 pages on what to do, and 10 pages on what to believe. If it had been a Christian book, he said, it would have been the other way round. 10 pages on what to do and 200 on what to believe. I think that's probably a fair comment, actually. And in fact, just to test it, I opened, just before I came here tonight, one of the standard Jewish introductions written by somebody else Introduction to Judaism, and it's got 100 pages, and God was mentioned for the first time on page 89. I can't imagine a Christian book waiting 89 pages out of 100 to get to God somehow. But go right back to the Bible, and that's where the Jewish problem starts, in a sense, because surely you think, right, back in the Bible, here it is, this is where we're going to find all about God. No, not at all. It takes God for granted, and it shifts the attention to the real centre of interest, the world we live in. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth. In other words, it's God's assumed, taken for granted, and the real focus is on heaven and earth and what we do with it. All right, let's go to Abraham. He was the first Jew. Now, how did he lift himself up from the paganism of his time? How did he get a sense of God? Maybe we can link into that and get a clue for ourselves. What was his special route, his search? What was the moment of enlightenment? Can we learn? No. All we hear is Genesis 12. God spoke to Abraham and said, "Go to a land that I will show you." Nothing about God, everything about Abraham. And which then leads on to 613 commands. We don't have 10, we have 613. Lots of do's and don'ts, but very, very little theology. And actually, certainly for the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, that's par for the course for the rest of it. Moses, think of him, or Gideon, they are both so unsure of God that they set God physical tests before they'll actually commit themselves. God's got to turn a rod into a snake to placate Moses and make a sort of a dry, a wet fleece dry to persuade Gideon. How that happened and how those miracles took place are unimportant. What is really important is the need for reassurance to overcome those doubts. And it wasn't just then, because many of the other prophets also initially refused to believe what they heard. In fact, Moses initially tells God to choose somebody else, doesn't he? Jeremiah says, "No, sorry, it's not worth my life, this God business." Isaiah claims that he's too unworthy. And that great biblical anti-hero, Jonah, doesn't even bother to reply when God calls him, but catches the first boat leaving town. Not for nothing do the rabbis point out that despite all the power of God, quote, "the one thing that is not in the power of God is the fear of God." Meaning that God can do what he likes to rivers and mountains, but he can't, and he can change the fate of nations, but he can't force individuals to actually believe in him. In fact, it took 2,500 years for us before another one of our greats, Moses Maimonides, came along in the 12th century and felt it necessary to write the 13 principles of Jewish faith. 12th century, right? He had to wait till then, till he wrote these principles to spell out what Jews should believe in God and what sort of God at that. It's really quite strange because most religions, and I think it's true of Christianity, start with a belief system. With we began with circumcision and kosher chickens. And whereas other faiths would have internal wars and sectarian heresies over the right and the wrong concept of God, Judaism, we never sought to tie God down in that sort of way. And that's why it's actually quite possible and quite legitimate to have very, very different images of God. And some Jews, for instance, will think of God, and I'm going to be a bit simplistic here, but just to give you the sort of wide range of images, God is a puppet master who sort of pulls the strings, controls the world, and orders our lives, and we are Pinocchios who are dancing to a divine tune. Or, for other Jews, it's the exact opposite. God is the watchmaker who pulls it together, who fashions it, who then winds it up and then stands back and leaves it to run of its own accord. And the world does what it does, the watch goes on, God is no longer part of it. Or maybe God, third image is the checkout operator at a supermarket till. And, you know, we spend our life going up and down the aisles, taking this, ignoring that, doing what we want. But eventually we have to come to the exit. And then God is there and adds up the sum of our life. Or how about another image? How about God as the still, small voice? The conscience within us that reminds us what we know we should do, even if we don't want to do. That we know what we shouldn't do, even if we really, really want to do it. Or maybe none of those. Maybe God, the source of nature, the regularity of day and night, the changing of the seasons, the world that we expect to be there every morning when we wake up. I mean, tonight we are all going to go to bed in the very confident assumption that when the alarm wakes us up, it will be light. And that there will be a sun and there will be birds and all the rest of it. And we just sort of rather take it for granted, don't we? But maybe that's the miracle that shows God. Now, all of these images are the Jewish God, or rather, the God of the Jews. And the reason why Judaism can be so relaxed about these different types of images is twofold. First, for us, it's a form of arrogance to say we know exactly what God is and isn't, and that we can define God and sort of mentally put him in our pocket and take God home. Because once you define God, you limit God. And second, the object of Judaism is actually not worshipping God. I mean, God really doesn't need our worship. The object of Judaism is getting on with our fellow human beings, which is summed up by a prayer which we say in every single service. It's called the Atah Gibor, and it states various things that God does with a strong message that these are godly tasks or goodly tasks that we should be doing. So it says God supports the sick. God supports the falling, God heals the sick, God rescues prisoners. In other words, that we too should support the falling, heal the sick, rescue prisoners. And that if we praise God, it is really just as a reminder of what you and I should be getting on with and the godly and goodly tasks that we should be doing. And in fact, you could say, and it's sailing a little bit close to the wind, but it's quite legitimate to say, that actually what's important is not so much belief in God, but it's the consequences of belief in God. In other words, that if there is a God, then certain things follow. And this is what's important, that the world has a purpose, that the life is basically good, that all people are equal, that individuals matter, that you yourself count, that we have a role, that you and I can do things that nobody else but you and I can do at a very particular moment to make a difference, if not to the world, at least to other individuals and to the circles that we move in. And there are many Jews who will fully subscribe to those things, even if they're less sure about the actual definition of God. So, with all these question marks flying around God or the existence of God or the nature of God, what can Judaism offer us, whether you believe in God or not sure or definitely don't? And for those who do believe, well, you're in good company, and Jews down the ages have believed and have prayed, certain that life is an amazing gift and worth giving thanks for. That doesn't mean to say that everything is perfect, or we don't have religious hiccups every now and then, but there is an underlying sense that there is a creative force behind the world, even if we can't put our finger on it, even if we can't define it, even if we can't persuade a Dawkins or not, for us there is that force, and more importantly, that force that gives purpose to our lives and meaning to existence. And just as we will sometimes use a chemical formula to define things, that H2O stands for water, so the word G-O-D stands for that force which we believe was somehow responsible for the world and somehow led to our personal existence and which impels us to act in a loving and a moral way and which we can't prove but we know is, we're pretty sure is out there in some respect. Long sentence, G-O-D for short. For those, and this is a very large category, who want to believe but aren't sure how or even can't, who have doubts and questions that get in the way, but would actually like to discover a means of overcoming them and able to find God, well, then they're in good company too. Because the Hebrew word Israel, which is refers primarily not so much to the land of Israel, but more to the people of Israel, and initially referred, of course, to Jacob, the patriarch, who changed his name. The word Israel in Hebrew means he who struggles with God. Hebrew is a very concise language, and therefore he who struggles with God. Five words in English is one word in Hebrew. And it refers to the centuries-long wrestling match between Jews and God. Doubting, arguing, questioning, but never letting them that stop them being Jewish. It's rather like the story of the rabbis who were discussing, this story back, goes back to the 14th century, who were discussing whether God was right to have created the world or not, and whether it was a mistake on God's part, given the way the world's turned out. And after lengthy cases for and against were made, they had a vote, and the verdict was given, namely, that it would have been better, given all the circumstances, if the world hadn't been created. God had made a mistake. And at that point, one of the rabbis turned to the other and said, "Well, now what do we do?" To which came the reply, "Oh, it's time for the evening prayers." So, yes, we complain, we debate, but then we get on with it. And if not with the prayers, then with the ethics and the values and the personal responsibility and the communal involvement. We wrestle with doubts, but still fulfill the practical tasks. And for those who are agnostic, in other words, who are genuinely not sure, who simply don't know if there is a God or not, well, join the queue. A queue, of course, started, as I hinted earlier, by none other than Moses, who was first in line, and who, when God speaks to him, initially he wants some proof, wants some hard evidence that God does exist, is not a figment of his imagination. And then, as I said, plenty of other biblical characters who are unsure as to what to think. But ultimately, it doesn't matter, because belief is secondary to action. Judaism, at least, certainly holds it that way. We do not have justification by faith, we have justification by deeds. And Judaism is about how you view your life, how you treat others, how you use your time on earth. Do that well, and that's what counts. You know, to be a good Jew, you don't have to believe in God. You just have to do what he says. And for those who are absolutely certain that they are atheists, well, actually, we have a lot of atheists in the synagogue, which may sound rather strange because they don't come for religious reasons, but they come for other reasons, for family reasons, or nostalgia, or a sense of community. But either way, they're still welcome. And what's more, they are Jewish atheists. Now, I'm not sure if you can have a Christian atheist. Perhaps you can tell me afterwards. Because, you know, either you believe in Jesus or you don't. And sort of, to me, that I would have thought that's a litmus test. But you can have Jewish atheists. In other words, Jews who have no belief in a deity, but who do believe in Jewish values or in Jewish peoplehood. Or who firmly don't worship, but still feel it's important to act as if there is a God. And certainly, you know, it's a long-standing rabbinic sort of sermonic device to say you should always act as if God was in the corner and watching. And how would you perhaps behave differently in the office, at home, if there in the corner was God? Now, that's not always a comfortable balance, but, you know, we're fairly good at keeping going, and we've often had to live with inconsistencies and juggle with compromises. Which is why I always used to like the way the comedian Dave Allen, who I'm sure some of you remember, the way he used to end his television shows. You remember his famous signature line, "May your God go with you." Which I thought was great because it chimed in so well with the Jewish attitude that, yes, there are many different concepts and images of God, including a blank space, and that, assuming there is a God, if God can live with us, having all these conflictures of him, then we don't need to get excited by the diversity afterwards. And in fact, there's a lovely story about, and it's a legend only, but it's a sort of teaching device of Abraham, who was supposed to be famous for his hospitality, and he was one day sitting in his tent, and an old man came along in the desert, and so he did what you know you should do in a desert: you invite the person in. And this man was in his 60s, so quite old by that time, and he gave him sat him down, and he offered him some food and water, and the man said, "Thank you very much, but before I." Eat, I'd like to say a prayer, which Abraham beamed, but then he lost that smile immediately when this old man got out a stone god and started bowing down to it, at which point Abraham snatched the god, chucked it out, and booted the man out of the tent. And at that point, a heavenly voice came down and said, "Abraham, if I put up with that man for the last 60 years, why couldn't you?" So deed has always been much more important than creed for Judaism, with much more attention paid to the right actions rather than the right beliefs. And so to end off, if you are hit by a lorry and terminally injured, and if a Catholic priest is passing by, he may well rush over and ask, "Do you believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost?" But if a rabbi gets to you first, he's more likely to ask whom in the family he should inform, and if you've made a will. For Jews, God matters, but what matters even more is what you do in God's name. Thank you.